Our first speaker today is Robert T. Holt, Professor of Political Science and Director of the Center for Comparative Studies in Technological Development and Social Change. He became director in 1967. A native Minnesotan and a Hamline graduate, he did his graduate work at Princeton University. Professor Holt has received numerous grants supporting his work in political science and the analysis of social systems, and has many publications to his credit. We are honored that he accepted our invitation to participate in Metro 2000. Our second speaker, Dr. Perry Blackshear, is a professor of mechanical engineering at the University of Minnesota. He is head of the Power and Propulsion Division. Professor Blackshear has been searching for new roles for engineers to play in healthcare delivery as director of a bioengineering training program, in alternative energy sources as director of the Center for the Studies of the Physical Environment, in ways that technology can influence social institutions by conducting a series of seminars since 1970 on the search for the recognizable goals and constraints of the study for the Earth. Professor Blackshear is a graduate of the Georgia Institute of Technology and received his PhD from Case Institute of Technology in Cleveland. An invited lecturer abroad and throughout the United States, we are honored that our invitation to participate in Metro 2000 was accepted. Ladies, Professor Holt.
Thank you very much. Let me start by telling you a little bit about our plans for proceeding this afternoon over the next almost 2.5 hours. I'm going to spend a few minutes here introducing you to the subject, Metro 2000, it's our responsibility. And I will be followed then by Dr. Blackshear, who will talk specifically about some of the engineering and physical constraints under which we're operating. After his presentation, I want to come back and talk a little bit about the problems of the social response to the kind of situation that Professor Blackshear has described. At that time, we will take your written questions, hopefully have a couple of minutes to look them over, and spend about a half an hour at the end trying to address the questions that you present to us. Metro 2000, it's our responsibility, is both a fascinating and timely topic. The past 4 or 5 years has seen a real burgeoning in literature about the future. Meadows, Forrester, the Club of Rome, these have almost become household words as we contemplate what is happening in our country, our city, and the world coming into the end of the 20th century. These works, by and large, do not paint a particularly rosy picture of the future that we confront. It would be difficult to call them utopian. In fact, I wouldn't doubt a bit if sometime in the next century, an historian looking back at this period and the writing may well refer to this literature as the futopian literature of the 1970s. Let me say at the outset that I am a skeptic on much of this futurist literature. I do not consider myself a futurist, and I'm skeptical about people that call themselves that and that write about the future. And part of the purpose of my introductory remarks this afternoon is to convey to you the basis for my skepticism. We are now entering the fourth and final quarter of the 20th century. Again, a timely year in which to talk about the year 2000. But let's start by looking back. Let's put ourselves back in the year 1900 and assign ourselves the task of predicting the state of affairs in the Twin Cities, in the nation, in the world, in the year 1925. What would we have done in 1900? The previous 50 years had seen the development and burgeoning of democratic countries throughout the world. The leading intellectuals and writers of the time were looking forward to a continual projection into the 20th century of an inevitable path towards democratic government in nations throughout the world. For almost 100 years before 1900, there had not been a major international war. There'd been skirmishes in the Crimea. The French and Germans had had at it for 6 weeks. The really bloody war was the American Civil War. But the European intellectuals, anyway, could attribute that to the quasi-barbarian character of the Americans. And the international system was able to contain that war and keep it from spreading to become a worldwide conflagration. Indeed, many people thought that the international system had developed a manner of avoiding major wars as a way of coping with international conflict. If in 1900 we would have looked specifically at the Twin Cities, at St. Paul and Minneapolis, we would have predicted continuing rapid population growth. We would have seen this growth developing largely along the emerging streetcar lines, and we would have seen the development, predicted the development of considerably greater population densities as the size of workplaces increased and it was necessary to have workers move in relatively close to the areas where they were working. Nobody in 1900, in predicting the future of the Twin Cities or of the country, would have paid much attention, I don't believe, to the horseless carriage, which was just a few years beyond the tinkerer's garage. Not very many people would have seriously taken the issue of powered flight. If we looked at those predictions from the perspective of 1900, we'd realize that before that quarter of a century was two-thirds over, the world was engaged in the greatest war it had ever known. By 1925, in the United States alone, there had been millions of automobiles produced. There were some very crucial inventions that probably were just dimly on the horizon in 1900. Most notably, the mass production of consumer durable goods. The invention, a social invention, of installment buying, which wasn't known before 1916. A social invention to pour tax resources into roads and highway construction, which led in that quarter of a century to the building of more all-weather roads than had been built in the previous history of our country. Who was the seer who would have seen that in 1900? But let's move on. Let's move on to 1925. In 1925, we were Charlestoning our way to peace and prosperity under the inspired, if not vocal, leadership of Calvin Coolidge. I won't try to list what predictions might have been made at that time, but let me list what happened. Within 6 years of 1925, we were in the midst of the greatest depression the world has ever known. Tens of millions of men unemployed. Before that quarter of a century was two-thirds out, we were again engaged in the greatest war the world had ever known. Who in 1925 would have predicted that by 1950 in the Twin City metropolitan area, flour milling would be in great decline? And by 1950, nobody would have thought of calling a baseball team the Millers or a producing firm Flour City. Who would have predicted the rise of Minnesota Mining or Minneapolis Honeywell? Industries based on research and education. Would you have seen that? Were you looking to the future of the Twin City metropolitan area in 1925? Would you have predicted that in the 25 years from 1925 to 1950, there would be virtually no residential construction for 17 years? It seems to me, again, it would have taken a kind of crystal ball, which we didn't have then, and I don't think we have now, to have made very accurate predictions about 1950 from the perspective of 1925. But let's move to 1950. And if our prognosticator had had experience with predicting in 1900 and 1925, what would he have done? My guess is he would have been quite a pessimist. He would have seen that between the First and Second World War, there was 20 years. If you project from that basis, this would have made 1964, 65, the beginning of the Third World War. Remember that January and February of 1950 was the beginning of a recession in the United States. And many astute observers would have seen the return to the conditions of the Great Depression. Who in 1950 would have seen the development of the Twin City metropolitan area suburbs emerging to a population which was greater than that of the central cities? Who would have seen the problem of racial minorities? Who would have seen the problem of violence in the streets? Again, I think it would have been very difficult to make accurate kinds of predictions. And simply because we have a high-speed computer that can run through a great deal of data doesn't mean that the problem of predicting the year 2000 from 1975 is really very much easier. I went over this for two major reasons. First of all, I wanted to draw your attention to the problem of the difficulty of predicting, even over a relatively short time period, like 25 years. Secondly, I wanted to draw your attention to the fact that so much that happened that crucially affected the development of the Twin City metropolitan area were events over which the people in this area had no control. The impact of war, the impact of depression, the impact of international technology. These are the kinds of things which a metropolitan area can respond to. But there is not very much that can be done within that particular context of affecting them. And yet the future of this area is very much determined by what happens in the developments of technology, in national policy, in international affairs. Professor Blackshear is going to be talking now about the environment, some of the limits that we face, and it's important to recognize that many of these things we have no control over. And the issue, if Metro 2000 is our responsibility, is how we are going to respond. Harry?
Well, as a futurist, I've been sort of cut down before I opened my mouth. All I've got left are a few dry numbers from books of thermodynamics that Dr. Holt hasn't challenged already. So I'll discard 90% of my talk, Bob, as being irresponsible since it's a futurist talk, and give you what seemed to me just hard numbers on which we could conceivably base a point of view when faced with a decision on what is a welcomed innovation, what is a promising innovation, and what is a threatening innovation in the years ahead. The thing I'd like to do is to look at the Earth's resources, the Earth's demographic patterns, and anticipate, if possible, with presently known technology, what the carrying capacity of the Earth is, and what technological development means to the management of population, and then view several things with the eyes of a thermodynamicist, namely the energy cost of the demographic transition to zero population growth, the energy cost of feeding a much larger world population than we have, the energy costs of supplying the water needs of a largely urbanized and industrialized society, the energy costs of supplying the materials of commerce to this industrialized world society, then have a summary view of what the Additional energy costs will be of living in a crowded world. And then talk a little bit about presently known supplies and what, if any, are the global limits of the energy use rate on Earth. Well, I'm supposed to hit the first button. This is our home. No responsible futurists that I've talked to or read represents the possibility or suggests the possibility that there will exist now or in the near future or in the distant future an escape valve that would let us produce people on Earth and ship them elsewhere to live and be nourished. There certainly is not ruled out the possibility of colonizing space, but colonization of space as an escape valve for the Earth's population seems to be out of the question. This sphere has an area of 51 billion hectares. A hectare, if you will, is about what the open space in a football field looks like. It's 2.4 acres. Of this, around 5 billion hectares are in forest at present. 3.8 are in grassland. About 1.5 billion hectares in agricultural land. A total land surface of 15 billion hectares. And this is what we've got to work with. It's not going to get any bigger. And I think we have to manage our affairs so that we can do it in this area. It's of interest, I think, to look at what our fair share of the Earth is. Our present population of about 3.8 billion people, if we had each of us our fair share, would own 1.25 hectares of forest, about 1 hectare of grassland, about 1/3 of a hectare of agricultural land, and about 10 hectares of ocean. There are a number of questions about limits to population, and as you may well imagine, as the population gets larger, the fair share of the Earth's surface gets smaller. Two numbers which I think are worth remembering. If you recall, our population now is around 3.8 billion. The National Academy of Sciences, in their recent book, Resources and Man, tried to analyze the impact of modern agriculture on the Earth's population and projected an upper starvation limit of the Earth's population is 30 billion people. In looking at the possibility of persuading developing nations in which the population growth rate is in excess of 2 to 3% to slow down their population growth rate, it's anticipated that a limit somewhere between 10 and 20 billion people might be reached through restraint, in which diets can be somewhat greater than, better than a vegetable near starvation diet, but that with the present age structure and the present increasing expectations in the third world, it seems like this is going to be a heroic job. So there's a very strong possibility we may actually reach the 30 billion mark. Plans for having a quality existence, however, that have been published and that I'll touch on briefly are made assuming that the heroic effort is made and it is successful and their population can be stabilized at 15 billion or less. It's interesting to look in the literature at what ecologists consider to be the optimum population of a particular region. One of the outstanding ecologists in the U.S. is Eugene Odom, who's a professor of ecology at the University of Georgia. He asked the question of his students, what was the optimum population for the state of Georgia? And their conclusion was one that gave every man 5 acres. We can see the basis for this. The argument is that you need about 1.5 acres of food-producing land. Now, I'm sorry about my switching units. University of Georgia hasn't yet switched to the SI units. Acre is 1/2 of a hectare. 1 acre of fiber-producing land, 2 acres in which natural processes can cleanse man's waste, and then about 0.5 acre for our industrialized trappings, making a total of 5 acres, or just a little bit more than 2 hectares per person. If we apply this optimum to the available forest and food-producing lands of the Earth, we would see the optimum population would be 4.8 billion. This is only 1 billion more than our present population, and we will pass through it within the next 10 years at our present rate of growth. One last number. If we apply Odom's optimum to the state of Minnesota, Minnesota's optimum population would be about 10 to the 6, about 10 times 10 to the 6, or 10 million people. What is that, about 2.5 times what we have now? The idea is that the more people, the merrier, the more educated and educable people, the more creative and motivated people we have, the richer our lives will be until we start stepping on each other's toes. And it's at this population that the benefit of having more starts really being a cost, both from our environmental point of view as well as our cost to our privacy. Now, there's an awful lot of debate on the impact of development on the so-called demographic transition. If you can imagine an innovation, for example, in the literature, the speculation on the invention of arrowheads and stone points during primitive times, and the invention of fire, where food that was not digestible before became digestible, and animals that were inaccessible before became meat on the table. And it's speculated that during the time of about 100,000 years ago and earlier, the population rose after the innovation, after these innovations were introduced, and then stabilized for a long time until about 10,000 BC agriculture was introduced. And there was another demographic transition. The death rate from starvation fell, the birth rate remained virtually constant, and the population grew again. The Western world, the so-called developed world, has gone through a demographic transition following the introduction of the Industrial Revolution and the sanitary innovations made possible by the work of Pasteur and his followers. And we went through a period in which birth rates greatly exceeded death rates, and we're now reaching birth rates by restraint without having them limited by starvation or pestilence, where the birth rate and the death rate are coming more nearly equal. The third world is just beginning its demographic transition, and there's a difficulty here that with the importation of healthcare technology and food growing technology, it's possible to have the population grow much faster than it's possible for the capital in the country to be invested to keep the per capita investment in capital equipment abreast with the productivity of the populace. One idealization of this curve is shown on this next slide. I'll have to ask you to ignore the data points and focus on the idealization. The solid line represents the difference between birth rates and death rates as a function of gross national product. According to Robert McNamara at his presentation in Stockholm several years ago, those nations that are to the left of the maximum on this curve need help from the developed world that has a higher gross national product, because when they leave their very primitive conditions of a very high birth rate and very high death rate, reduce the death rate, they have the capability of producing people much faster than they have the capability of producing wealth, producing institutions, and therefore easily slide back into this, what you could call the Malthusian box. And then once over the maximum, everything that happens, a little more industrialization gives more alternatives to having kids in the population, the birth rate falls, the death rate stays low, and the countries that were above zero population growth rate when this curve was produced are now very close to it in the developed world. So it looks to be possible with industrialization to arrive at ZPG, but it does seem to be mandatory that assistance be given to those nations who are to the left of this imaginary maximum. Now, this, of course, is an idealization. It's not agreed upon in the literature by any stretch of the imagination. I think an excellent discussion of it can be found in the journal Science, the May 2nd issue, in an article by Mike Teitelbaum. It's May 2nd. Mike copes with the arguments that have been presented by people such as Garrett Hardin that say that this transition has occurred only in Europe. It hasn't been demonstrated in Asian countries. It would be impudent of anyone to propose a policy that was based on the European experience and expected to work in the third world. Teitelbaum has researched this very well and has some cogent arguments saying that it not only should work, but could probably work better. But he agrees that there should be alternative courses to follow. Just two things I think ought to be said in regard to Teitelbaum's article. The industrialization of the developing world is a sufficient condition to carry them to a low population growth rate. It's not a necessary one. There is sufficient evidence in Europe that changes in attitudes on the part of the populace reduce population growth to zero before industrialization and the increased options occurred, so that it's not necessary to have industrialization to achieve ZPG, but it's sufficient. Now, I think the two extreme policies based on this debate probably could be cited as the McNamara proposal, which says what we really ought to be doing is giving 0.7% of the gross national product of all these nations that have made it through the demographic transition back to those that are having difficulty getting over the hump, and exploiting this sufficient condition that Teitelbaum writes about, that will then ensure these nations will achieve ZPG in time. Garrett Hardin, on the other hand, says, nonsense, there's no evidence that the third world will respond in this fashion. As a matter of fact, there's evidence that it will not. For example, Kuwait now has a higher per capita GNP than we have and a birth rate of something like 52 per thousand. So that the issue is by no means clear. Garrett Hardin, you probably have read or heard, advocate something called the lifeboat ethic, in which we stay rich, hold on to what we've got, husband it for our own, and kick anybody out that tries to crawl in the lifeboat. And my discomfort there is when I look around, I see Bob Holt trying to shove me out of the lifeboat, and it's not very comfortable for me either, because he sees if it works for keeping the developing world out of our goodies, things would be better if they got rid of those fat engineers. So I'm unhappy with the lifeboat ethic. I would hate to have my children live in a world in which it was the dominating ethic. I guess you could call Bob McNamara's ethic the golden rule ethic, and what I'm going to say afterwards presupposes that there are at least some of you who feel that the golden rule ethic is the one that engineers ought to be thinking about rather than building higher gunnels on the lifeboat. So I have just one other thing to say about the demographic transition, and that's to try to put it in the perspective of energy, that there are many, many versions of this plot. The more recent ones, after the reevaluation of the dollar, bring the U.S. and Canada considerably further to the left, so that Switzerland and Sweden look to be the people with the highest per capita gross national product at less than half the per capita energy consumption that the U.S. This is a plot, by the way, of energy consumed per capita on the ordinate and per capita gross national product as a measure of quality of living on the abscissa. The idea of this plot is that up to about Sweden, an increase in energy use per capita means an increase in standard of living. Now, if an increase in standard of living means a reduction in birth rate, it's, I think, follows linearly that an increase in energy use per capita is a birth control measure. So to achieve ZPG, we need an increase in the energy use per capita. By the way, the maximum on McNamara's demographic transition curve could be achieved if we split all the energy use that takes place in the world equally. The average falls right on the top of that curve, so that when you hear people who are against redistribution of wealth make the argument that it doesn't do any good, here at least is one counter-argument that says redistributing wealth could help achieve ZPG. I'd like to talk briefly about the energy cost of food production. As you recall, we have now a little less than half a hectare of land, of agricultural land, per person. That makes it possible for us at this point to use the organic method of methods of farming, to use low energy farming throughout the world, and only a few places like the U.S. where we have gone to very much industrialized farming practices have we gotten away from the yield of one man per acre for a vegetarian diet. We can do considerably better than that using machinery and using chemical fertilizers. However, this curve shows the food yield per acre plotted against the additional fuel required to make the yield possible. And we see that as the world gets more crowded and we get more than one man per acre of ag land, and as we aspire to have a diet better than a vegetarian diet, our need for adding energy to agriculture will increase, so that energy will be required to increase the productivity of food as the world gets progressively more crowded. Right now, we use on dry summers to I'm now switching to water. On dry summers, we use a substantial fraction of the Mississippi in passing through our sewage systems in Minneapolis. It's predicted that in a dry summer by about 1980, we could use it all. This is not a very cheering prospect for the citizens of Winona and further south, but the fact dramatizes the water dilemma in the U.S. and in the world. Many of our urban concentrations really are literally running out of water. And the way that's proposed now to replace it is to desalt seawater or to purify wastewater. Both processes, on a basic thermodynamic point of view, do cost energy, and in a practical point of view, cost quite a bit of energy. So that as the world gets more crowded and the natural rainfall no longer supplies our demand for water, energy will be required for that. Then, as far as materials of commerce is concerned, can anybody read that? Let me just use it as a reminder of the two points I wanted to make. I have listed here, comes from Limits to Growth. This is the list of metals or energy resources. The second column is the known global reserves. And the numbers that I'd like to call attention to are column three, which is the static index. That's the number of years the commodity would last if we use them at our present rate of use. The fifth column gives the number of years the commodities would last, or the minerals would last, if we continued to grow exponentially in our use. And if we were to achieve a distribution of consumption throughout the world at our present population, where everyone in the world used materials at the rate we use it, we would have the longevity of these materials shown on the far right side. And we see such things as mercury would last 3 years, and lead would last 5.9 years, gold 2.4, and aluminum 13.5. Now, the next slide attempts to do much the same thing. And I think this is where the supporters of Garrett Hardin would say, see, what you would like to do is to have us fighting over metals if you start feeding the people outside the lifeboat and helping them industrialize. Now, the Atomic Energy Commission under Alvin Weinberg has taken a hard look at this problem and says you can divide these things, minerals, into two categories. One category, such as aluminum and iron and magnesium, which is in abundance in the Earth's crust. Virtually tens of percents of the Earth's crust are made up of these materials. And therefore, we simply have to go to lower grade ores. This means disturbing more of the Earth's surface and spending more energy to concentrate the ore. But the energy spent turns out to be ridiculously small, about a percent of our present total energy budget in the U.S. The the other kinds of commodities, for example, mercury and lead, which are not in abundance in the Earth's crust, but localized in various places throughout the crust, will reach a limit. We'll find substitutes for them, it's true, but those uses for which no substitutes can be found will demand recycling, and this is costly, so that the two different categories of minerals, both of them use more energy as the Earth gets more crowded if we're to supply the growing aspirations of the third world, but it can be done if there's enough energy. I'll skip the fuel problem for a minute and go directly to the summary budget of what we're going to have to do in a crowded world if we are to use the golden rule, be proponents of the golden rule ethic. First, let me remind you that our present United States energy consumption, this figure was prepared in 1970, but amount of energy shown, or power consumption shown in the upper right-hand corner of 10 kilowatts per person is the present Minnesota energy consumption. We use a little more for comfort heat and a little less for manufacturing than the nation does, but our average is very nearly the national average. If you see 10 kilowatts is about the power consumed by a Volkswagen traveling at 55 miles an hour down I-94. It's about five times what the average household uses on the average. It has been growing at a rate of around 5% per year, but since the advent of the energy crisis has slowed down considerably. The cost then for going to lower grade ore, as you see, is only 1% of our present energy budget. The cost of recycling the scarce elements, however, amounts to 20%. So it really is a very costly thing when we run out of these materials. And compared to our present U.S. per capita energy consumption, it's still only 20%. That 2 kilowatts per person, however, represents the world average energy consumption. So on a world average basis, to go to low grade or to recycle these scarce elements will mean a doubling of the Earth's present per capita energy consumption. To make up for convenience fuels, this figure shows the electrolytic generation of hydrogen. It was prepared by Weinberg, who's a cheap atomic energy, or a man who advocates cheap atomic energy, and chose this method. There are other ways of making substitutes for petroleum that may not have the scary aspects of nuclear power accompanying them. Water desalting will not cost much. The air conditioning of cities apparently will not cost much. Agriculture is very inexpensive, and sewage treatment and environmental cleanup is very inexpensive. If you add them up, the providing a standard of living equivalent to the U.S. standard of living in 1970 to everyone in the world, in the face of our limited material resources, would cost an additional 6 kilowatts per person. And if you add a contingency of 4 kilowatts per person, this is the energy budget per capita that we would expect to have to meet of 20 kilowatts per person. Now, this is two Volkswagens or possibly a Nova going down I-94 at 55 miles an hour, and it doesn't seem like a prohibitive amount of energy, but when you multiply it by 15 billion people, it starts to rival it overwhelms the amount of energy fixed by photosynthesis, and it starts giving great concern to people who feel that we might be inadvertently moderating our Earth's climate. Now, this is two Volkswagens or possibly a Nova going down I-94 at 55 miles an hour, and it doesn't seem like a prohibitive amount of energy, but when you multiply it by 15 billion people, it starts to rival it overwhelms the amount of energy fixed by photosynthesis, and it starts giving grave concern to people who feel that we might be inadvertently moderating our Earth's climate so that it becomes less habitable. So let me then address first the possibility of supplying this amount of energy for any length of time, and second, the likelihood of moderating the Earth's climate if we were to supply this amount of energy. Just to review, if the world were to industrialize, the arguments appear to point to the fact that population would stabilize, and the faster we could industrialize, the faster we could stabilize the population, and the lower the stable population would be. If we have enough energy, we can stretch our resources indefinitely by going to low-grade ores or by recycling. We can increase our food production to give high-grade food for 15 billion people, and we can desalt seawater, and the cost is only 60% of our present per capita in an energy budget in the U.S. And the question is it altogether impractical to consider doing this for all the people of the Earth? And first, let's look at the now famous pattern of production rate of oil. This bell-shaped curve is what the oil production rate is going to look like over the next few years, if King Hubbard is correct, and the dashed line which goes out of the paper is the projected demand. This is in barrels and doesn't help us much, but if we can read this, anything on this next slide, let me read it for you. First, if we multiply 20 kilowatts per person by 15 billion people, this adds up to 300 terawatts, 300 times 10 to the 12th watts. So the units on this slide are conveniently put in terawatts with this kind of global thinking in mind. So recall, what we need is 300 terawatt years for the indefinite future if we're to give 1970 quality of life to a stable population of 15 billion people. We see that coal could cover the world quantity of coal is estimated as 1,000 terawatt years, so it could cover the this high standard of living for 3 years. Petroleum would cover it about a third to two-thirds years. Natural gas, again, about a third of a year. So that with all of the fossil fuels combined, we might get 4 years of support for a world as consumptive as this. The nuclear option, on the other hand, this is Chauncey Starr's data from the University of California. The if we don't use the breeder reactor, we could get 10 years worth of energy from a nuclear fission reactor, and perhaps greater than 1,000 years if we were to have a successful breeder and we didn't kill ourselves from the possession of it. In the meanwhile, we are now burning at a rate of 5 terawatts per year. Recall the target number would be 300, so that at 5 terawatts per year, coal and gas and petroleum look very good indeed for at least a 10 to 20 year period for the Earth as a whole. If we look down at the bottom set of figures, let me just point out the amount of solar radiation that's coming in. We get 28,000 terawatts around the clock from the sun. Recall the target for the fully developed industrialized world is 300 terawatts. So if it were possible to harvest 1% of the income solar energy, it would be possible to live on income in the steady state. Now, the literature on energy now asserts that we have to leave liquid or fluid fuels, liquid and gaseous, and go to solid fuels, coal and uranium. The head of the Ford Foundation financed energy study, Freeman, said there are only two things wrong with coal: you can't mine it and you can't burn it. The environmental distress caused by mining is terrible, and the engineering problems of either cleaning up before you burn it or after you burn it are really awesome. On the other hand, uranium has a great deal of detractors in the country at large and in this state in particular. The two things that bother me were summarized by Alvin Weinberg himself in a very thoughtful article in Science 2 years ago, in which he points out that it is technically possible to have a nuclear reactor that is arbitrarily safe, providing we can have well-trained, highly motivated, well-organized, and reliable social organizations that transcend anything that's ever existed in society before, and providing the social structure in which this technology is embedded is stabler over orders of magnitude longer times than any society has ever been stable before. Otherwise, with either social disruption or disaffection on the job, the well-laid safety precautions of managing nuclear energy will almost certainly lead to some disaster. And the price that the decision that has to be made, and is apparently is being made in our country now, is that are we really so desperate for energy that we would like to pay this price either for coal or for nuclear energy? Now, there is apparently only one other course for us to take in the U.S. Let me just touch briefly on this. This is a plot of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere versus time. The top curve is the total number of carbon dioxide that has been injected into the atmosphere over that period of time, and the bottom curve is that amount which is still there. Half of the carbon dioxide that has ever been injected into the atmosphere is still there. Carbon dioxide emits the visible light from the sun, traps the red that re-radiates from the Earth's surface, and causes something called the greenhouse effect. Were it not for carbon dioxide and water vapor in our atmosphere, the mean temperature of the Earth would be minus 20 degrees centigrade as opposed to the plus 14 or 15 degrees centigrade, which it is. As the amount of carbon dioxide increases, there's an increased likelihood, all other things being equal, that the Earth's temperature will warm, and the consequences of this are, according to some models, some pretty horrendous changes in the climate. The other aspect of power generation, golly, look fast, guys. Just look at a few numbers. The radiation that hits the Earth's surface is up in the upper left-hand corner, 178,000 terawatts. This is in contrast to the 5 terawatts that we're generating from all of our power plants now, or the 300 terawatts that we'd be using for a completely industrialized world. The other two numbers I'd like you to look at are the numbers for winds, waves, convection, and currents. This is our whole weather system. It's just a little more than 300 terawatts. And then all of photosynthesis, meaning plant fixation and the processes of decay, consume 40 terawatts. Two schools of thought argue against exceeding these two numbers. Odom and other ecologists say that we may well be the only living thing if we inject more than 40 terawatts of energy left on Earth. The climatologists feel that if we inject more energy into the atmosphere than is presently being dissipated in all of our present weather systems, that we will almost certainly modify the climate. Now, none of these numbers can be supported by any hard mathematical models of the atmosphere. Our climatologists and meteorologists haven't gotten that clever yet, but they're getting there. And as we approach the time when we should be worrying about inadvertent climate modification, there is hope that we'll be able to predict more accurately at what point things that we're doing on a global scale will influence the climate. And then, just to finish off on what this means as far as applying industrialization as a means of keeping our own good life without having to resort to the lifeboat ethic, and as a means of helping stabilize the world's burgeoning population. We have to decide, do we want to pursue this, or is anything that has been said recognizably ludicrous? Can you prove that 300 terawatts would inadvertently modify the climate? The answer seems to be we don't know. Prudence demands that we not go beyond 300 terawatts, but there's an awful long way to go before we start worrying about that. So go ahead and try this fix, at least get up to the level of Sweden and Switzerland energy consumption in the third world, and we'll keep worrying about our meteorological models until then. But what can we say about the U.S. in the meanwhile, already at a little bit better than 10 kilowatts per person? If we take the view that the U.S. will abide by some global per capita ceiling on energy release, When we arrive at a crowded world that's sufficiently crowded that we threaten to modify the climate, would the U.S. Abide by the ceiling placed on the rest of the world? If we said we would, that ceiling will ultimately be somewhere between 10 to 20 kilowatts per person, but that's our energy consumption at present. I think it would be exceedingly difficult for us to soar to a 50 kilowatt per person society and back down. So there are numerous authors, for example, Carl Barris of Swarthmore in the June 1975 issue of Mechanical Engineering argues that the time has come for us to start making our progress in the U.S. Without increasing our per capita energy consumption, because it does look like in the steady state, if we can achieve it, our allotment will be about what it is now, based on climate modification limitations. And then just two things in closing. This is Dixie Lee Ray's Project Independence map. This is the equivalent in millions of barrels of oil. About 7 million barrels that we imported in 1973 has to be replaced by something else. It's proposed that we replace it in part by fossil fuel production increase domestically, primarily in coal, expanded non-fossil production, that would be nuclear, and then this open space is conservation. This is one of many publications that argues that just about the only way we can have progress in the near future in the U.S. without having our economy and our employment possibilities jeopardized is to exercise very stringent conservation measures. You see, if we pull the tip of that import curve down so it meets what Dixie Lee Ray is saying, that from 1973 to 1980, we should count on living with a zero energy growth rate. And let me give the one possibility for Minnesota. This is our residue production in Minnesota. If you add it all up, it comes to about 25 million tons of cellulosic material. 20% of this now is on land which really suffers from these residues. The farmers would love to get rid of it, and it constitutes a fuel that with about two-thirds to three-fourths the heating value of South Dakota coal. Can be picked up and ground and delivered for a fraction of the cost of hauling the equivalent amount of coal. And a lot of these sources are near very large coal burning facilities that could be modified for their use. The material, cellulose, is in a form which lends itself admirably to the making of synthesis gas from which ammonia for fertilizer or methanol or synthetic petroleum could be made. And finally, there are 2 million acres of Class 5 land in Minnesota begging to have cattails grown on it. Cattails grow at the rate of 30 tons an acre, so we could actually be an energy exporting state if we put our mind to it and develop the technology to handle it. This renews itself every year. There certainly are problems attending it, for example, soil deterioration, and if it's practiced in those areas that are unsuitable for it. But in our wetlands, I would imagine we could have energy farms operating for decades before that became a concern. Thank you.
Are we getting time?